Now the king is drawn to the daughter's beauty, and the men cut down the trees with axes. What does this suggest? Well, it suggests the attraction of opposites. The masculine represents phallic power and penetration and discrimination, and the feminine needs the masculine in order to trigger further change. So if a woman dreams that a man is breaking into her home, this may be a frightening image to her, but it is usually a positive one. It usually suggests that it's the beginning of an important inner change, as the masculine in some way is going to change her personality. But in this story, it's important for us to notice that the masculine is only an aspect of the Great Mother. The masculine doesn't seem to operate independently. I'll say more about that. Now, the mother drops from the sky, and this is a particular intense image, and it suggests something. It suggests that the mother is a sky mother. And what could this mean? Well, it suggests dominance. It implies that the Great Mother is ruling an early stage in the development of consciousness. In other words, it seems to represent a time when the maternal principle dominates the ego and the identity, and everything else exists in relation to the maternal principle. And there's a beautiful image of this in Egyptian iconography. It's an ancient image of the god and goddess Nut and Geb. Geb is the earth father, and he lies on his back, naked on his back, on the earth, with a huge erect phallus reaching up into the sky. And Nut is the sky mother, and her naked body arches over the ceiling, over the heavens, creating the sky. Her feet are on the ground, and her fingertips are on the ground, but her body arches up into the heavens and down again. And there are stars on her body, and you can also see the sun and moon there. In fact, the sun is shown as traveling in a boat across her body from her feet, across the back of her body, and down her hands again, down her arms again. And the passage of the sun over her body is the passage of the sun through the sky during the day. So this image from Egyptian mythology shows that for the Egyptians, it was the mother who dominated consciousness. It was the mother who dominated the sky, the world of ideas, not the father. The father was a fertilizer and bound to the earth. So at that time, there was not a head masculine, not a sky god like Yahweh or Zeus from our Western mythology. It was a time when the feminine dominated the sky and dominated awareness and consciousness. And perhaps this is how it seems to a young child in the first years of life. The mother is the great dominant power in a child's world, and the father's role is not controlling, but perhaps the father only stimulates action at certain times of day, as far as the child can see. The mother who comes down from the sky deals death. This mother is a huntress. She has the power of life and death over animals. And she kills the king's soldiers with a needle. But notice that her weapon is feminine. She is not phallic like a man, but phallic like the original woman. And later, when she is called back, she kills zebras and people and harvests the herds of her mother and father. So she is the great mother who is responsible for both killing as well as nurturing. And we don't always see the killing side of mothering, but it's always there. It's obvious to us, perhaps, in farming. The farmer composts the old vegetation. He grows apples and prunes the tree. He raises hogs and chickens and then slaughters them. He raises the wheat and then reaps it. So the farmer is not only the nurturer of livestock and crops, but also the grim reaper. And we know that children imagine sometimes making their siblings or their parents go away and never come back. And grown-ups sometimes do the same. And in a marriage, both partners may be unconsciously caught in the archetype of the death mother. For example, in a marriage, a wife and mother perhaps is the dominant figure, and the husband is boyish in the home and ineffectual or absent and alcoholic. And the wife colludes in his alcoholism. And then we discover that the wife's mother was also strong, and the wife's father was also ineffectual and alcoholic and absent. And when the wife's mother visits, then there's more trouble between the husband and the wife. The husband becomes even more childlike and ineffectual and addicted. Such a wife had a dream, dreaming about her mother and herself. The wife dreamt that the wife and her mother were in an open plain, and there was an alien spacecraft above them, and it was killing things on the ground with a death ray, and the wife and her mother would have to escape. And this dream shows that the two women were controlled and threatened by unconscious deathly attitudes, attitudes being ideas or things that are in the sky. And we know that doctors, although doctors may be consciously identified with conquering death, may sometimes convey to you that you are sick and that you may get sicker. And we know that teachers, though they be consciously identified with a student's progress, sometimes convey to a student that the student is a failure and always will be. And there you see both doctors and teachers can be unconsciously identified with the death mother. And as analysts, it's all an issue of consciousness. If we can be conscious of our deathly side, if we sorted it out carefully, then our patients tend to thrive. But if our own deathly side is unconscious, then we are liable to act it out, and then our patients may not thrive. Now the daughter is bound by umbilical cords, and this is an extraordinary image. What might it mean? Well, umbilical cords seem to bind the daughter to the web of life. They bind her to her past, to her present and her future. And cords weave fate. They suggest the life cycle that cannot be stopped. Either we cooperate with the stages of the cycle, or we are dragged through them anyway. And the weaver is a creator. And another image for the weaver is the spider. And these and the spider and the weaver are both images for the Great Mother. So you see, the Great Mother weaves fate, weaves everybody's fate. And in this story, we see that the Great Mother, in fact, seems to act on both sides of the conflict, both on the side of keeping the daughter in the tree, and she weaves the whole story and leads to the daughter's transformation. And then there's the mortar and the pestle. What does that suggest? Well, it suggests that things can be ground to their essence. We can get to the bottom of things, or that we can seek to understand at the deepest level. And this is what happens in analysis. The ego is pulverized to ashes, and that's the meaning of contrition, or the realization of sins, or the realization of the shadow. And that leads to uncovering the darkest layers of evil within. So the mortar and pestle suggest analysis, or whatever process served a similar function in this African village culture. And then the mortar pounds by itself, handless and sinister. And this suggests nature's own mill. It suggests the relentless grinding of nature, which is impersonal and endless, and sometimes destructive and evil. And it suggests that nature does include great evil, which we must face consciously if we are to be fully conscious. Now, of course, nobody's fully conscious, but we must try as best we can to face the evil that is around us. And then the daughter goes into the ground. And what does the tale offer to explain this? Well, the dove explains it. She says, "You who dig, she who nurses the sun is gone. She who nurses the sun is gone." And these enigmatic words spoken by the dove are underlined and affirmed by the wives as being the right words. They say, "Go, you know how to do it, you." Now the dove is a bird that flies over our heads. So it again suggests ideas. It suggests nature's ideas. And in fact, the wives have been discussing which of the birds has the right idea. And in fact, the dove's words are the key to interpreting the symbolic meaning of the whole story. So we see that nature, paradoxically, not only fights to preserve the unconscious state, but also, here in the figure of the dove, provides sparks of insight which lead to consciousness. Now the phrase is, she who nurses the sun, and what does that suggest? Well, perhaps it suggests that the daughter is like the seeds of corn. Because you see, corn seeds ripen and develop their yellow round bodies. They look like little suns as they ripen. And by ripening, they're absorbing the sun's energy and nursing it inside their own bodies. So it's the corn seeds that nurse the sun. And then the corn seeds are pushed into the ground to grow new crops, pushed into the ground just as the daughter has been pushed into the ground. So now, with this understanding suggested to us by the dove, we can recognize that this myth is like the story of Persephone in the Greek legend of Demeter and Persephone. Demeter was the earth mother, the goddess of grain, and her daughter Persephone was plucking flowers in a meadow. When the ground split open, Persephone was seized by Hades and taken to the underworld to be his bride. And Demeter, grieving and enraged, made the land barren. The gods wanted to appease Demeter, but Hades also had a claim on Persephone now that she'd been into the underworld. So the gods agreed to a compromise. So now Persephone spends 6 months with Demeter and 6 months as Hades' queen. So now we have summer and winter, according to the Greeks. So in our tale, the daughter is a corn seed like Persephone, and we're reminded that the mother is not only a sky mother, but also an earth mother like Demeter. And the daughter sinks into the underworld, into the realm of the dead, the realm of Hades, and connects with its secrets. In other words, with the ultimate mystery of death and life and transformation. And so it is with inner growth. We are separated from the outward life. The energy is withdrawn from outer life. And instead, we become empowered in the realm of the archetypes, the realm of the underworld. The archetypes become empowered. And then the woman sends the dove with its message to the mother in the sky. So though the daughter is buried, her spirit rises and carries a message. And this image of the daughter being buried under the ground and of her spirit rising and flying into the sky, this is related to the image of the resurrection of the Holy Ghost. It's the same image arising in a completely different cultural context. And it means the same thing. It suggests that when we enter the archetypal realm, when we enter the underworld, then messages will reverberate throughout the personality. And as a result, new consciousness will develop. Change will begin. So then the mother returns, killing all. And this is the mystery of the harvest. As Demeter, grieving, makes the land barren, old life is killed, and this prepares for transformation. And that's the effect also of analysis. In analysis, we have to grieve past losses. And that takes the life out of the old structures whose time is past and makes room for the new. And there is another point about the mother's killing. The creativity of the feminine, which belongs to the young daughter, the basket weaving, has been blocked by envy. And the result is murderous narcissistic rage. And that's what happens to us when our creativity is stifled. Fury will go somewhere. It may take many forms, perhaps depression or self-destruction, but the reaction is inevitable and fierce, and we need to be aware of it. Now the mother sprays medicine, and the daughter reemerges. And so the corn sprouts in the springtime, and Persephone returns to Demeter in the spring, and the cycle is completed. After something traumatic has been deeply analyzed, after all the injury and pain and fury has been faced, then spontaneously, organically, like new sprouts of grass, a hopeful, joyful feeling may emerge. And here the story comes to an abrupt end. And thus it emphasizes that this return is the whole point. The feminine has renewed itself. The story is finished. Now, how does this story differ from the story of Demeter and Persephone? The differences are very significant. Persephone is drawn into depth by Hades' passionate desire. He makes her his one queen. But in the African story, the passion between opposite sexes is less central. The man is polygamous, the king is polygamous, and he goes away as soon as his daughter comes home. He doesn't stay with any of his wives. And most of the action is driven not by the attraction between opposites, but by the envy of the other wives and the mother-in-law. And all of these, remember, represent aspects of the Great Mother. And you may remember that envy was predicted by the man when he first saw the daughter. He said, all the other wives would leave. Now, envy is a force between peers and siblings in the same nest. It is envy that drives the daughter into the depths, and envy that causes differentiation and individuation. What does this mean? Well, perhaps it refers to the stage of development which this story is about, a stage when the Great Mother still rules, when the masculine is not an independent opposite power. And we've already seen other internal evidence that the masculine is not an effectual power in the story. Well, how does this African story apply to our modern inner life? Where would we see it in our times? In fact, we see it everywhere. We see it whenever nature needs to take its own time, whenever we might say, in the fullness of time, or when the time is ripe. That is, whenever the psyche needs to unfold at its own pace, not according to the ego's urgency or the ego's plans. And a direct example would be a daughter in her early teens and her mother, in which there are so many issues of timing. The daughter is still a child and needs mothering, but she's entering womanhood, and the mother is feeling older and displaced, and it all needs to unfold between the two. And if the masculine, in the form of boys, entered at this point, it would be too soon. As a therapist, when I'm dealing with narcissistic injury, the patient may feel that interpretation is too penetrating, may feel like a destructive intrusion, and I can only listen, perhaps to much killing energy, and let things unfold vegetatively. This is again a time when the masculine, the penetrating, discriminating energy would not be appropriate, and nature has to take its course, follow its own rhythm as the narcissistic injury heals. Another example is a man in analysis. He had learned something in his analysis which he had never known before, and he wanted to write a book about it. But then he dreamt that he was standing in an area of dense, lush rainforest, and it was being exploited for its wood. So you can see that the masculine cutting and discrimination was not right here. The dream was telling him that his timing was off. It wasn't time to exploit the riches of the unconscious. The psyche needed to unfold according to her own cycle. In conclusion, our traditional African fairy tale is like a parable from the Bible, which speaks to our modern Western psychology. It shows how the feminine differentiates itself in her personality at times when the masculine is peripheral, when the feminine must unfold according to its own rhythm, when development is driven not so much by tension between the opposites, but more by the forces of rivalry and envy. Well, that's all for now. I hope you found this lecture interesting. Thank you.